The prime ministers of Zaire and Rwanda said today that they'd reached an agreement on an enormous and immediate repatriation of more than 1 million Hutu refugees, refugees who fled to Zaire from Rwanda in 1994. Last year, Zaire forced thousands of refugees from Rwanda and Burundi to return home. It has warned before that it would close the refugee camps, but the United Nations says any repatriation must be voluntary. If the agreement announced today is put into effect, it could create a new crisis. The Hutu refugees are afraid to return to Rwanda out of fear that the Tutsi-led government will carry out reprisals for the 1994 genocide. Many relief workers say the Rwandan situation demonstrates the need to prevent conflicts before they create refugees, or at least to intervene quickly when fighting erupts. In the final report in our series on refugees, NPR's Ann Cooper tells us about one successful intervention in Haiti.
The Haitian army officer in charge of torturing Pierre Augustine beat him, watched him throw up, then forced him to eat his vomit. It was the early 1990s. Haiti was ruled by murderous dictators. So when he managed to escape his tormentor, Augustine joined a refugee flotilla fleeing the country. Augustine spent months in exile at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where Haitian refugees composed a musical plea to President Clinton. Clinton, grant our request, sings Augustine. Help our president return to Haiti. In 1994, President Clinton heeded that request, sending 20,000 U.S. troops to oust Haiti's military rulers and restore its democratically elected president. Refugee Pierre Augustine rejoiced and went home. President Clinton declared a foreign policy success. And on the beach at Laogan in southern Haiti, once a popular refugee departure point, boat workers remember the U.S. intervention with gratitude.
If the U.S. did not come, things would have been bad. It would have been, there would have been a revolution here. There would have been a bloodbath. Now, I don't believe there would have been one Haitian left. Everybody would have been killed.
Some 70,000 refugees boarded boats at beach points like Laogan during Haiti's 3 years of military rule. In the year after American troops arrived, the number dropped dramatically to about 1,000. Humanitarian workers call Haiti an excellent example of a refugee crisis that was solved by foreign intervention. If the world were more willing to get involved, they argue, it could even prevent crises before they happened. Lives could be saved. And money, says United Nations refugee official Ray Wilkinson.
Money spent now will save a lot more money spent further down the road.
Wilkinson cites the example of Rwanda. When genocide engulfed that tiny African country in 1994, the United Nations declined to intervene. Later, though, when 1 million Rwandans poured over the border into Zaire, the UN led a huge relief program to feed the refugees and fight a cholera epidemic in their camps. The cost for the first 2 weeks alone, says Wilkinson, was $2
billion. $2 billion on aid, keeping those people alive. If even a fraction of that kind of money had been used in Rwanda before, when all the danger signals were still there, but it hadn't degenerated into genocide and so forth, the whole problem may not have developed.
Preventing crises like the Rwandan genocide is such a tantalizing idea that it spawned a cottage industry of conferences and research centers. They study a still fuzzy concept called preventive action. Depending on the situation, preventive action might mean negotiating power sharing between political rivals, or sending peacekeepers to defuse an ethnic confrontation before it turns violent and creates new refugees. Of course, peacekeepers aren't always welcomed by the local factions. And for American politicians, any talk of intervention is haunted by the 1993 deaths of 18 U.S. Marines in Somalia. Stephen Stedman, a professor of politics at Johns Hopkins University, says the so-called Somalia syndrome explains U.S. reluctance to enter hotspots like Bosnia or Burundi.
Unless we can do something very quickly, at very low cost, and in a convenient way, we don't want to do it. So we're terribly prepared, you know, very ill-prepared for any kind of dealing with collapsed states, any kind of preventive strategies, and there's no patience for any of that.
Haiti was an exception because, unlike the Rwandans or Bosnians, refugees from Haiti were sailing straight for American shores. A politician who might say, "Where's the national interest in helping faraway Burundi?" could literally see the U.S. interest in the Haitian crisis. Ostensibly a mission to restore democracy, the U.S. intervention in Haiti was also designed to staunch the flow of refugees, which it did, though perhaps only temporarily.
Okay. Lieutenant Commander Wall, she's the executive officer.
Hi. So we don't have a translator?
Huh? Yeah, they have a translator.
At the waterfront in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, U.S. Coast Guard officers are returning 103 would-be refugees picked up on the high seas. Almost 2 years after the U.S. chased out Haiti's dictators, American officials say there's no longer a political reason for leaving the country. So people like these, who were found drifting in a leaky sailboat, are called economic migrants, not refugees, and sent home.
81, 83.
A Coast Guard officer counts the Haitians carefully as they step back on shore. These returnees don't deny economic motives for their flight, but as they describe it, Haiti's broken economy is just as life-threatening as the thugs of the former military regime.
Our situation, you know, is worse now than it was during 91, 94. And they should let us go even if we die at sea.
Why is that? What's worse now?
We have no food, we have no work, we cannot earn anything. And we have family, we have wife and children, and we cannot feed them.
Haiti is still the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, with massive unemployment and almost no prospect for improvement. U.S. and United Nations missions in Haiti have focused on strengthening democracy and human rights, but there's little of the long-term economic investment that Professor Stephen Stedman says is essential to prevent new crises.
This, to me, is a recipe for future disasters. It's almost as if you're ensuring that there's going to be this cycle of dependency and cycle of collapse. And every time it happens, we're going to throw money at it in, you know, for relief efforts, for refugee resettlement, for humanitarian disaster assistance, but it will always be after the fact, after a lot of people die.
Ask the people who work with refugees how to stop that cycle, and they say it's clear. The international community has to get involved in a crisis before people take flight, before TV cameras record the anguish of another refugee camp. But in a post-Cold War world where refugees have lost their strategic political value, the will to get involved is very weak indeed. I'm Ann Cooper reporting.